The Guardian.
Hello everyone, this is Guardian Football Weekly. Today, Manchester City trouble the Vidi printer, scoring seven. Crystal Palace are even more surprising with two in their first win of the season over a depleted Chelsea. Just when you thought Arsenal weren't in crisis, they're back in crisis. And fortunately, no one built up the Liverpool-Manchester United game too much, but that was bad. Elsewhere, a hat-trick for Icardi as Inter win the Milan derby, late goals in France, and we'll speak to Sid in Spain. Your questions, feedback corner, put it all together, and it's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel. Barry, you're back.
Hello.
We missed you terribly.
Did you? Good.
Has anyone left a dirty protest on your chair?
I didn't check.
So. We'll find out at the end, yeah. I guess. He's so Irish, he's Norwegian. It's Burnley hater Lars Sivertsen. How are you?
How are you doing, Max? I'm none of those things.
I know you aren't. Before the last pod, we always ask what everyone has for breakfast.
Yep.
And you said lasagna. This didn't go on air and everyone was shocked. This morning, when we were saying what you had for breakfast, you refused to tell us.
Yep.
Can you tell us, please?
Because it caused such an outrage. And like, I'm just like, if you're sharing a house with someone and your significant other creates a big hearty dish at the weekend and there are leftovers, so when you open the fridge on Monday morning, there are the leftovers, they're just staring you in the face. So you can make a breakfast, or you can just eat the leftovers that you know are really tasty, and it'll set you up for the day. I don't think there's anything wrong in having those leftovers, even if it is a lasagna. But this clearly was too much for the good people here at The Guardian, so I will refuse to say what it was this morning.
What did you have for breakfast?
I'm not telling you.
Was it a roast beef dinner?
I'm not telling you.
It was a roast beef dinner, because he already know he had a roast beef dinner for lunch. Oh, hang on. Did you have something else for dinner?
I'm not. Listen, this has gone too far. I'm not having
this. Is like Paxman. What? Come on, Lars.
No.
Please.
I'm very stubborn.
Go on. Okay. Dom Fifield, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. A bit worried about Lars, but other than that, I'm fine.
First pod of the season.
First pod since around 2008, I think.
Oh, wow. Where have you been?
I have no idea.
I've made this rotting in the reserves analogy too many times.
I think I've just been doing Chelsea crises ever since.
Well, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
And we'll get on to a minor Chelsea crisis in a minute. But let's start. Manchester City 7, Stoke 2. How many points are Manchester City going to win the title by, Barry?
15.
Lars?
Nah. I think it'll be 9.
8. Dumb.
You say 8. Yeah. Ale says, City are going to win the quadruple. Let's give it to them now. When is this pathetic long-term conclusions from short-term from going to stop from football pundits and journos? They could be scoring 10 goals a game for all I care, but you can't trust them.
That seems kind of harsh. I mean, the only sign of weakness I've seen in them so far this season is when they played Liverpool. Looked a bit ropey in defence, but I think you can look a little frail in defence if you're going to be banging in goals like that at that rate. They were absolutely wonderful to watch at the weekend. Went 3-0 up, then let Stoke back in the game. Stoke, as Mark Hughes said, sort of prodded them with a stick by getting two back, and then just made them mad, and they went on to just put on a scoring masterclass, goals coming from all over the place. Kevin De Bruyne instrumental in most of them. Some of his passing was just incredible.
I agree with you. Those assists. There were two assists for De Bruyne. I think it was the fourth and the sixth. Just side foot passes that were just weighted to perfection.
He is incredible. And with the sort of vision and the precise delivery he can provide, with both feet, by the way. So it's such an impossible thing to defend against for a defence. And it means when he has the ball, even if as a defence you look at where he is, you look at where the other players are, and you figure this is probably not a very dangerous situation. It is, because he can find runs that you didn't know were there, and he can find angles that don't exist. And it's such a nightmare to play against. It must be.
He is sensational. And every performance he puts in like that leaves Chelsea cursing that they let him go. But they've got ammunition from all over the place. I mean, Leroy Sané is a sensation as well. David Silva never gives the ball away. And that was a team that scored 7 without Aguero. So, I mean, it is frightening. I mean, I think they're on target for 138 goals this season.
Okay, well, yeah, but 29 in eight games so far. Yeah.
And I have a pet theory that they're actually slightly better now without Aguero, because it means you've got Sané and Sterling in their best positions,
yeah.
And Jesus has looked amazing. And as good a goal scorer as Aguero is, I do think that 3-5-2 formation was a bit of a fudge, basically, to be able to play both him and Jesus without upsetting anyone. And I think they're even better now.
It's interesting you mentioned Sterling. Yas Rana below the line said, I hope that Sterling gets a good mention on the next pod. He doesn't look out of place in a genuinely world-class attack. For all the talk about Kane, who's obviously brilliant, Sterling has been just as good, if not better, so far this season, yet rarely gets a mention. Producer Jonathan also wants to talk about Raheem Sterling, but not enough to come in and do a little section of the podcast, but he wants us to talk about Raheem Sterling.
Well, I mean, I covered the England games, and whenever Sterling is with England, he flatters to deceive, and that sort of the frustration wells up because we see what he does at City. I think it's 6 in 6 now in terms of goals in Premier League games, and so you see the capabilities he's got, and you want him to tear it up in the same way with England. And obviously England don't play in the way that Manchester City play, obviously tapping into his strengths, but there's so much ability there, there's so much potential there still. He's still young. I mean, he's on with England, he's on course for an amazing number of caps. I think he's got 30 odd already at that age. It's sort of a few behind Rooney at the same stage, but you know, we're up there far more than Beckham ever had at that stage of his career. So he could go on and do anything really with his country and with his club. If he carries on playing in the City team, then he'll continue to improve.
Do you think, Dominic, that why is it he doesn't play as well for England? Is it the weight of the shirt, as they say, or just because he isn't surrounded by the similar quality of player, or a bit of both?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, certainly he's not surrounded by that calibre of player and a team that's as comfortable in the way it's playing in the expansive style of football. And I think the first mistake he makes in an England shirt brings the crowd on his back as well, largely because those supporters see him tearing it up with City every week, and they want to see that in the England environment, and it just doesn't seem to happen. I mean, I still think it can. I think if Sterling is playing like this, you'd still put him in your England first choice team, but we want to see it more consistently at that level.
Danny Murphy said Gabriel Jesus is the best youngster since Messi, the best young prospect since Messi. Lars, how would you go along with that? I mean, he could easily break Aguero's record. Has Aguero got it now? Has he even equaled it? Or not
he's
got it yet?
He's still short. The rib Tony injury Brooke. Was slightly right. Untimely. On that.
So he's been wearing the T-shirt underneath for so long.
One short, isn't he? He missed the penalty that would have given it to him.
Ah, that's right. But where do we see Jesus as a prospect?
He's incredibly good, that's for sure. And he's a perfect sort of centre forward for this system because he has a little bit of everything. He's mobile. He can finish really well. And he's actually not bad as in the air either if you put crosses into him. And he seems to... His movement is very clever, which is perfect for all these great passers he has around him. I think this sort of best things that best since that and best since this. I'm so like not a fan of that way of talking because it's so vague and strange. But he is incredibly good, and obviously, if he stays fit and he plays every week as a centre forward, and City keeps working as a team and as a unit this well for a prolonged period of time, you would imagine he will break quite a few goal scoring records. Of course,
you made a good point on the radio yesterday about how David Silva ruined the chance to make that second goal for Man City, goal of the season.
Well, he had a poor first touch, and that's what I will remember from this game. David Silva's uncharacteristic sloppiness in the build-up to the goal he did go on to score. And it took the gloss off an otherwise very entertaining game for me.
Hey, Man City play Napoli on Tuesday night, also in that group Feyenoord Shakhtar. That's an interesting game. City and Napoli, isn't it?
Really looking forward to that. I saw we got a question on Twitter, like, are there anyone who's more fun to watch than Man City at the moment? And the first team that sort of came to my mind as being close is actually Napoli. So, I mean, it's probable that they're going to modify their approach a little bit to this game. I mean, they were, from the match reports I read, slightly more pragmatic against Roma at the weekend. But Napoli have been amazing so far this season. So that could be one to watch.
That's 0-0 then.
That is a very interesting group because I think Shakhtar Donetsk are a lot better than everyone expected. That rolled a grenade in at the opening game by beating Napoli, a result which no one saw coming. They also played very well in defeat against Manchester City, which would suggest, you know, they could yet have a say. They could still get out of that group and certainly have a say in how it finishes.
Crystal Palace 2, Chelsea 1. Dom, you were there.
Professionally, yes.
Ah, did you have a nice time?
Professionally, yes.
Oh, good. And what did you make of it?
Well, in 10 years covering Chelsea, that's the worst. It's up there with the worst first half performances I've seen them put in. It was staggeringly bad. And it's almost as if the players had started to believe Antonio Conte's constant whinging about about the schedule and the lack of depth to his squad. I can see where he's coming from. I think he obviously wanted more players in the summer, and he didn't get those the senior players that he wanted to bolster the numbers in the squad. You can have your argument about whether they should have let quite so many youngsters go out on loan. When you see Tammy Abraham scoring a brace at the weekend, and Michy Batshuayi being substituted before the hour mark at Selhurst Park, and he was bad. That was a bad performance. But in terms of positivity from that game, it was something that Palace desperately needed. The whole place had a lift with Zaha's return and with Julian Speroni's selection. And you could tell really from the first few exchanges that they were up for it, and they haven't been like that this season. They've started games slowly and they've been playing catch up, and confidence has been so brittle that they haven't been capable of reviving in matches when they've been behind. But that performance will give Roy Hodgson huge heart for going forward, and suddenly they don't quite look the certainties for relegation that people were saying they were.
Wilfred Zaha as a striker is something that intrigues me a little bit. Cause,
was it him and Townsend?
Funny system, but yeah, that effectively, yeah. But
especially because Zaha is one of those guys, he's got so much going for him, in terms of his physical attributes and in terms of his skill with the ball and all of this. It is desperate that he's not become a bigger player yet than he has, to be honest. Now, that's no offence to him or Palace, but the potential there is so much greater than what we've seen.
It depends what you're measuring that against. I don't think any Palace fans would suggest that he's not a big player. I mean, his absence the last 6 weeks shows how big a player he is for Palace. I mean, he is the chaos factor. He's someone that you don't know what he's going to do next. And I mean, Chelsea, Cesar Azpilicueta and David Luiz were terrified of him on Saturday.
Absolutely, and that was the caveat I was adding, because I'm just thinking for his natural talent, he could be making more of himself. And I'm really intrigued if this playing him up front could be the solution, because he's got so much going for him. And like you say, if you have a guy like him with his skill set, if he gets the ball anywhere near the opponent's goal, they have a problem, no matter who they are and how well they're defending. Well,
it has to be the solution at the moment, because the alternative is Bakary Sakho. I think he is something else. He liberates other players as well, because opponents inevitably get drawn towards Zaha. And that, I mean, Townsend, that was his best performance of the season today.
I was just going to say, actually, his return seemed to bring the best out of Andros Townsend, give him a new lease of life. They were really quick going forward. And the thing about the game is Palace were never really... It wasn't a back-to-the-wall performance where they were hanging on. You know, they were still making opportunities in the closing 10, 15 minutes and never really looked in much danger of surrendering the lead. If anything, looked like they might increase it.
Christopher writes, are Chelsea fighting for a top four place already? And if so, who should take the blame?
I think it's probably a bit too early to say that. We have to just go back to the same stage last year where they were just embarking on that 13-game winning streak. He is capable of, this is Conte, is capable of coaxing remarkable sequences out of players. Who is to blame for... Well, look, I think that there was an issue. There was a schism in the summer. There was an issue between board and management. He wanted more players in. The board wanted a different type of player in. And they never really found a proper compromise on that. It will test them. Four competitions is too much for this squad to be challenging on all four fronts. It's just too much. And to be honest, that performance at Atletico Madrid, which is only last month, earlier this month possibly, it just feels an age away. That was a completely different Chelsea. And the City and Palace games they suggested that's a team that's had the stuffing knocked out of it.
Could this be the gods of football punishing Conte for making that sort of cheeky dig at Mourinho in the summer, saying we must not have a Mourinho season?
But I think that was him making his point, wasn't it? That was him saying you've got to do something, Michael Emanalo, Marina Granovskaya, you've got to go out there and bolster numbers in my squad. And there's an uneasy balance at Chelsea because of the number of players they have out on loan, and you look at them and think, well, surely some of those guys could do a job in this Chelsea team. And I go back to Abraham. I mean, okay, you can argue that maybe he wouldn't progress quite as quickly if he's playing 18 games at Chelsea, most of them off the bench, compared to 32 games at Swansea. But he would have offered a lot more than Batshuayi. I mean, Conte went after Llorente in the summer, a 32-year-old, strong, tall striker.
Beautiful. striker as well.
Beautiful striker, fine. But that is a clear indication that he thought Batshuayi was third choice even then, and now he's reliant upon him.
Roma on Tuesday. You're going to that?
Wednesday, yeah.
Wednesday, sorry.
Yeah, and look, that's an opportunity for them to get going again. They've done so well in that group so far. I mean, that Atletico result was phenomenal, and it's given them some breathing space really at the top. They can just get a couple of results against Roma, avoid defeat in those two matches. They're virtually there.
Pleased for Roy, who said afterwards, "I'm off to Southampton to watch Newcastle tomorrow, so my wife, who's accompanying me, can't say I don't give her a day out." So the thought of taking the future Mrs. Rushton to Southampton versus Newcastle, I don't know if I'd get too many brownie points. Another game no one enjoyed was Liverpool 0, Manchester United 0. Does it deserve any discussion, Barry?
Well, normally we gloss over 0-0s, but I suppose these are two big, top six teams, so we have to talk about them. It was a terrible game. If you say that Jose Mourinho approached it very negatively, you'll get abuse from Manchester United fans, but he did, and he got what he wanted from it. He set out not to get beaten. His team didn't get beaten, and Liverpool deserved criticism for not being good enough to break down Manchester United's defence. Eight men behind the ball at all times. Romelu Lukaku isolated up front and visibly getting more and more frustrated as things didn't work out for him. It's not a huge amount else to say, really.
It's funny because I don't know why I thought they might go for it. Alex said whoever predicted Mourinho and United would go for it at Anfield should have to be subjected to a Roy Hodgson training session. But I thought they might, given how many goals they'd scored already.
But think of it from like Jurgen Klopp's perspective. Like, you're having a bit of a bad time. Your team is kind of, your defence is looking sort of strong and stable in the sort of Conservative Party meaning of the phrase. You're missing chances, so you're not winning that way. And you won 1-7, and then you have to play like your biggest rival who's on great form. Like, if you're Jurgen Klopp, you go into this game like really worried about a lot of things, and then Mourinho goes and doesn't attack you. Like, he's done him a great favour there, really.
Did anybody else, and this is the most important point for me, hate Manchester United wearing grey with white shorts? It just doesn't go. It's got to be all grey. All grey or no grey?
No grey.
I would suggest that possibly wasn't the most depressing thing about the game.
Hey, Jose's been speaking about how he loves PSG and doesn't want to stay at United forever. Jacob Steinberg sent a tweet going, "I'd love nothing more than to see Mourinho telling Neymar to track back and protect his fullback when PSG visit Lyon." He did an interview with...
Jacob is joking there, but he raises an interesting point. I can't help but wonder what Manchester United's players must think of being forced to play in this manner with, the handbrake very much on. I wouldn't imagine, that's not why you go to play for a club like Manchester United, to have the stalls set out in that way and not be allowed to express yourself. I also would love to know what Alex Ferguson, who was at the game, as he is at most Manchester United games, what he made of it. Like, he must be just watching through latticed fingers.
He used to do that at Anfield quite a lot. He didn't score that many goals at Anfield over the years, yeah. I think it's we look back at the Ferguson era and we remember the swashbuckling performances, but we choose to forget the dour draws at Anfield.
It is a great point, though, Barry, the message you send to your own players. Like, you saw the way City approached the game at Chelsea the other week. Like, we're really good. We're away to Chelsea, but we're going to go out and play them off the pitch. Whereas United, you go to Liverpool, who, they're not a team of Leo Messi's. Like, they've won one in the last seven, and they keep leaking goals, and they don't score very many, right? And you go there, and you tell your players, we can't defend these guys. It's too dangerous. We cannot play against this team. Like, that's a pretty negative message to send to your players, isn't it?
That's an interesting aspect of it, isn't it? Because if City do go and attack teams away and they come away, they hitting six at fourth place Watford or winning at Chelsea in the manner in which they do, then maybe a point at Anfield is no longer quite, good result.
Yes, I was wondering, do the way City are playing, at some point, if Manchester United want to win the league, they almost have to change what they're going to do.
So the tweet you read out at the start of the show saying people are overreacting to a few good performances from Manchester City, you also look at the performances of the teams who are going to be challenging them, in inverted commas, for the title, and it's hard to draw any other conclusion that they will continue to pick up points, put distance between themselves and a chasing posse who, on the strength of what we've seen so far, Manchester United are probably the only team that are good enough to keep within breathing distance of them. But we also need to remember, in 10 games against the Big Six, Chelsea or Jose Mourinho hasn't won one of them in the last 10.
Some more from Jose's interview. He almost took over from Frank Rijkaard at Barcelona in 2008, but turned down the opportunity, and Pep was appointed instead. And he says, quote, "Maybe I will reveal the truth one day. There is something about my career that I want to keep secret. I will tell the truth when I will be really, really, really old." So slightly Trump. It's some nonsense that Trump sort of comes out. I wonder if you know what that secret is below the line, please. So that was 0-0 Liverpool, Manchester United. Watford 2, Arsenal 1. Arsenal in crisis again. Troy Deeney's comments were brilliant, weren't they? "Whenever I play Arsenal, I'll go up and I'll think, let me whack the first one and see who wants it. I came on today and jumped up with Per Mertesacker. I didn't even have to jump, actually. I nodded it down. The crowd gets up. Yeah, we've got somebody who can win it. And they all just backed off. For me as a player, I just think happy days. That's my strength. If you're going to let me do my strength against you, you're going to have a tough afternoon." I wish more we all want more footballers to be as open as that. But if you're the Arsenal fans listening, or the players, or anyone listening to that going, "He's just come on and said, I just bashed someone, and then I went, right, I've got this." It's like Sunday League football. It's literally going hard on that tiny little fella and see if he wants it afterwards. And Mertesacker's in the tallest. He's in the tallest team we built a week ago. But you know what? How you know? Keown was in this TV studio. It's like tearing what's left of his hair out.
But it does remind me slightly of, and I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but I believe Tony Adams had this idea that you need seven. You need seven fellas in the team who, like, if it kicks off in the tunnel, they'll run towards it, not away from it. There was something along those lines that Tony Adams once said.
How many have Arsenal got?
This is the thing. If you look at this current Arsenal squad, like, you're not getting to seven at all. Not even close.
Arsene Wenger was very unhappy about the penalty, which I think he said something like it was a disgrace or not.
Scandalous decision.
Scandalous decision, that's right. What do we think, Dom?
I thought it was telling that if you pick up the papers today, you've got Mark Clattenburg saying that it was a penalty and Keith Hackett saying that it was a dive, which basically shows that no one's got a clue. There was contact. He was running at pace. He went over, but I think he went over very easily and very eagerly. But it wasn't scandalous. It wasn't a scandalous decision at all. I mean, it's perfectly...
I think if the shoe had been on the other foot,
yeah. Well, there you go.
Wenger would have expected to get a penalty. And the fact of the matter is that Arsenal should have put the game well beyond Watford at that point.
Yeah, they should have done. Andrew says, "Would Barry Glendening have scored Ozil's miss?"
No.
It was on your left foot.
Yeah, probably not.
No.
I'd have made a better fist of it than he did, but I'd probably have missed. I'd be pretty confident. If you put me in that cauldron with the goal at my mercy.
The 50 million price tag on your head.
Yeah,
and the constant crowd messages being, saying you're lazy.
Yeah, I'd have missed.
Okay. Gomez made a very good save. Was that from Iwobi before that? So, it's a game they should have won, but sort of typical. It's typical.
I liked also Troy Deeney got stuck into his own son after the game. Yeah. That was beautiful. His son Miles was a little mascot. And after the game, Troy Deeney, he's an Arsenal supporter, prefers Olivier Giroud to his own dad when it comes to football.
I think we all do, though.
And
don't we?
Well, yeah, I suppose. And he said he'd already got a text from his boy saying, "I hate you, Dad." And he didn't seem to mind that much and said he'd be shoving it up to him for the rest of the week.
Mike Wallace asks, "How far will Watford go in next season's Champions League?" Dom.
Well, they have been fantastic so far. Let's not get too carried away just quite yet in terms of European qualifications, but Marco Silva's done a magnificent job. He slotted in. They've had so many managerial changes over the years, but Walter Mazzarri was a sort of was possibly a mistake, but everything else has been progressive, hasn't it? All their appointments have been slightly better than the one before, and I think Silva is clearly a fantastic coach, and he's making those players better. He's got a central midfield, I mean, which apart, outside the top six, and they're not many better than that. Abdoulaye Doucouré is a revelation, absolute revelation. This is a fellow who was playing at Stade Rennais with Bakayoko go back 6 years, and his career was going nowhere, and yet he just looks fantastic. The whole setup is good, and you know, long may it continue. They've got options as well. They can play in different ways. Andre Gray's made a difference. Deeney's there as a backup and seems to be content almost to come off the bench and do what he does. Well, they've got a lot going for them.
Can Tom Cleverley win England the World Cup?
he could go to the World Cup, possibly. I mean, he's playing. There's so few options in central midfield with England that Cleverley has to come back into the thinking at some stage.
Yeah, I said it in a flippant way, but actually he is playing well. If you're him and you look at someone like Harry Winks, who is not played that much, coming in ahead of you, I suppose he's a slightly more technical footballer, Winks, but they picked out some stuff on Match Today of Cleverley looking like he actually can play the ball forward quickly to another player, which is, you know, the issue that we have, isn't it?
Maybe his pass stands against him in a way that Winks's doesn't, you know, because
Winks was eight, you know.
That's Cleverley, we've seen what he can do, but we've also seen what he can't do and how sometimes he can't do the things that he's doing now. So that he has that baggage maybe that Winks doesn't have.
There was a time when Cleverley was Roy Hodgson's go-to man with England. He was the first name on the team sheet. I mean, it's strange to think of that now, but he really was. He was a regular in the England setup.
Before we move on from the match, like, and I, as a tangent, take it a little bit back to the penalty thing, because I heard over the weekend, like, and I don't want to name and shame, but I heard the sentence.
Name and shame and tell us what you had for breakfast.
It's not. it can't have been simulation because there was contact. Like, this is the dumbest thing. We have to stop doing this. Like, if there's any kind of contact, it can't possibly have been a dive. It's such a thing that you hear this in England so much, and you have a lot of ex-players saying, if you feel contact, you're entitled to go down. Like, this is stupid. This is really annoying and dumb, and it needs to stop. Like, very helpfully, the laws of the game provide a very clear definition of what simulation is. And let me read. An action which creates a wrong/false impression that something has occurred when it has not, committed by a player to gain an unfair advantage. Like, it doesn't have to, like, if someone taps you on the shoulder and you roll over because you're in the penalty area and you're a striker and you're entitled to go down, says everyone. Like, this is diving. This is simulation. This is trying to create a false impression that something has occurred when it has not. You've not been knocked over.
Yeah, but I'm more annoyed with Lovren than Bellerin over the weekend. You know, Bellerin went down, but Lovren, you know, rolling around as if basically been punched in the face by Mallet.
That's also the same thing. Can we agree, Max? Like, it should be possible to both punish the foul and, like, punish the exaggeration. Like, I mean, theoretically, something should be possible. Could be both.
You can give a penalty and book the striker for diving.
I think this should
be
possible.
I'm in favour. Are you in favour, Barry? Just in a word.
No.
Okay. That's part one. In part two, the rest of the Premier League. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. This is part two. Let's start at Wembley. Tottenham 1, Bournemouth 0. Spurs are third. They're still not particularly good at home, or disproportionately better away from home than they are at home. Barry, what do you think?
Well, I suppose they've got a monkey off their back for a while at least. It wasn't a particularly good performance. Hugo Lloris had to make an outstanding save to stop Spurs going with a goal down. They were forced to change their formation at half time, which, I don't know, maybe you could say is a suggestion that Mauricio Pochettino didn't get it quite right from the start. But, you know, it was a pretty straightforward win over a team that sort of struggling this season. So I'm not sure how much you can read into it. But
Christian Eriksen scored the goal. Lovely finish. Morten Tuno sends a question from Denmark. How do you guys rate Christian Eriksen compared to the legend Michael Laudrup? Club and national team included. Thanks. Thumbs up. Lars.
He's quite a different player, isn't he? I mean, Laudrup was this amazing sort of ethereal sort of creative guy. But Eriksen is... what I like about him is that he's a very logical player. He picks the right decision very often, and he plays, even though he's got this extraordinary technique, he often plays the simple layoffs and the simple flicks, and like when he gets a chance, he tries to pass it to the side of the net rather to blast it somewhere. And like if you go through Laudrup's sort of highlight reel on YouTube, he did some unbelievable things. But he's a slightly different player, and in terms of greatness, he's obviously not there yet. But you know, he's still a young man.
Jose Fonts has did an interview talking about Pochettino. Slightly creepily, he says Pochettino watches you everywhere. Everywhere in the training ground, there are cameras. If he was giving the bibs and you were not in the team and your body language was bad, he'd call you in the office and say, listen, this is not the right way. In the canteen, everywhere. He is watching you everywhere. Your body language, everything. He is meticulous. His attention to detail is second to none. He would watch everything you do.
Yes.
I once, at the Spurs training ground, sort of had a standoff with Pochettino at the door of the press conference room, where he was sort of holding the door, or no, the door was open, and we both arrived at it at the same time, and each of us kept insisting the other go first, and I eventually went first at about, I don't know, the 10th time, because I thought he's going to get mad and deck me if I don't just go in before him. But I thought, well, you know, it's your house, you go in. But anyway, yeah.
Well, it's lucky you did, otherwise the two of you could still be there. Brighton 1, Everton 1. No one saw it because it was only on in India. Yeah, Everton they're just a bizarre. We've said it before, and it's not like I imagine anyone can say anything new about the bizarre state of signing all these slow, incredibly gifted number 10s and not having anyone to run after the ball. You know, it's Sunday League. You would pick players that would complement each other.
Absolutely. It's a shocking indictment of their summer transfer window, really. I mean, we all thought they'd actually done pretty good business if they brought a striker in to sort of semi-replace Romelu Lukaku, and they haven't really done that. We thought Nias might provide a few answers for a while, but then we remembered that actually he's not the answer, and there was a reason he wasn't in the Everton team for a year.
Barnaby says, Everton, what do you think? Is it time to commit to a Gylfi-centred strategy? Is it time to just say, Gylfi Sigurdsson was so good at Swansea because you built a team around him? I mean, You've got to do that, and that means leaving Klaas and Rooney out.
If you're Everton and you spent like 40 million on Sigurdsson, it's insane not to do that. Like, why do you spend like a massive club record fee on a player and then play him in a position and in a system where he doesn't look comfortable, and you, like, what's happening?
Was it on this pod or somewhere else that someone raised the issue that possibly by the time they bought Sigurdsson, they didn't really need him anymore and just did it out of politeness?
I mean, well, there's a truth to that, isn't there? I mean, he's probably, I don't know where he, I don't know what you think about who's the best central attacking midfielder that they have. Is it Sigurdsson or is it Klaassen? It's probably a Sigurdsson. So then, you're right. He's there, but you bought a few others.
Yeah. I mean,
saved the money.
I think they need a defensive midfielder, you know. They need a striker. Whether or not Ronald Koeman will be trusted to buy those players remains to be seen. I would personally stick with them because I don't think they're in any danger of getting relegated. They're guaranteed to be three teams worse than them, but you know, do you trust? Sorry,
it'll be Walsh who signs the player, whether Koeman's there or not.
Okay,
that's. I mean, there are, for a team that's been lacking pace, why hasn't Lookman had a look in? I mean, it's there are so many anomalies about Everton's season so far,
but they all seem so strikingly obvious.
Yeah,
that's what's weird,
which makes you wonder whether there's a political thing going on, whether Koeman and Walsh actually get on.
But Lookman's problem is surely that they're trying to accommodate all these number 10s that they didn't need, that they can't fit into the team.
Width. Surely there must be a way of... I mean, you'd think there would be a way of getting him in there, surely.
In other interestingly TV scheduling news, as this game was moved to the Sunday because they thought it would be on TV and then it wasn't put there, is that right? Or it was chosen by Indian TV, but Sky went with the Derby Forest game. Haringey Borough turned down the money from the BBC to broadcast an FA Cup game because they didn't want to reschedule a car boot sale. They wanted to honour the local people, give them their car boot sale, which is important for low earners. And some of the players wouldn't have been able to make an early kickoff because some of them work on a Saturday morning. There's some romance is not dead in football. Swansea 2, Huddersfield 0. Swansea's first win since August when they beat Palace. Nareo says, important question. Is Shinji Okazaki in danger of losing his best smile in the Premier League crown to Tammy Abraham? I would throw Wilfried Zaha in the mix as well. I think Okazaki is still ahead because I think he's permanently smiling even when fouled or just running around, whereas most players save it for celebrating.
Must be a Croydon thing if it's Abraham and Zaha. Then everybody smiles in Croydon.
Local radio reporter, I was covering the local elections count in Croydon overnight. I can tell you I didn't smile.
I think it was Croydon was found to be like one of the least happy boroughs in England in a survey a couple of years ago. I'm just, you know.
That's made me miserable,
has it? Well, look, maybe you're right. You hit upon something. Look, but Huddersfield were a bit unlucky in that game. Are you worried about Huddersfield yet, Barry?
I am a bit, yeah. You know, obviously they're going to lose a lot of games, but they seem to be looking a bit leggy already at this early stage of the season. And, you know, the manner in which they play, relentless pressing and running, gadding about, would suggest that the future... I would be concerned, you know. Anything 17th or better obviously will be a triumph for them. I thought they'd surprise a few people this season, and they have. I wouldn't be pressing the panic button at all yet, but I'd be a bit concerned for them.
We shouldn't forget how extraordinary it is that they got like promoted in the first place. It's incredible that they're here.
Oh no, once they're up, the expectations change.
Yeah, well, but they've been very sensible, like in the transfer market. They haven't bet the house on staying up, and I think 9 points from 8 games, like they would 100% have taken that before the season started. Absolutely. So, of course, it's going to be tough for them, obviously. But
26 and a half years since he last scored against Newcastle. Marco Gabbiadini does it again. Southampton 2, Newcastle 2. Fraser Forster didn't have a great game. Daniel Storey, I think, tweeted, is he the worst goalkeeper in the Premier League?
No.
I would say Wayne Hennessy. I mean, I don't want to...
Well, you just have.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be noticeably out of their depth, both of them. Dom would know better than me. Is Wayne Hennessy just a dip in form, or is he just not very good? I think Forster's been quite poor for a long time.
Yeah, I think Hennessy's struggled for a while. He doesn't look the same player with Palace that he does with Wales.
Yeah.
That happens to quite a few Welsh players, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, Gareth Bale possibly aside, but yeah.
He does okay, does a job for Madrid, I guess. Jeff says, are Newcastle been given enough credit for their performances and where they sit in the league since apparently we have a championship squad?
Well, isn't it their own manager who's been saying that? I noticed they've been doing noticeably well since the transfer window shut and Rafael Benitez has just been forced to get on with making the best of the squad he's got, and I don't think it's a particularly bad squad.
It's a young squad, definitely, isn't it? That's very impressive.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing, isn't it? Does anybody want to play What the Hell Was Andy Carroll Thinking? I mean, what? Like,
I think if there was a thought bubble, it would be that one from The Simpsons where Homer has a thought bubble and it's one chimpanzee picking nits off another chimpanzee's back. Just, I don't think there was much going on in there.
When he sets off, he's just been booked. I mean, we're so close together. You can see him setting off a mile away and you think, he's not going to really just... I mean, you just wouldn't do that, would you? You've just been booked. You'd probably just lie low for maybe 5 minutes at least.
It was a proper sprint into that second jump, wasn't it? It was remarkable.
So maybe he thought, like, the ref's just given me a bit of a soft one for an elbow. He's not going to give me another one. Like, I'm going to go straight in there.
It was worse, though.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that he was thinking he might actually get away with it since he'd just been booked.
I mean, it's an interesting tactic to think, I've just done a mildly bad challenge, I'll do a worse one.
But there are oddities like that. Like, there's old maxim that you can just twat someone within the first 5 minutes and you probably won't get sent off. You know, there are things like this. And I think there are quite a few refs, I think, who would have bottled that decision because he figured, I've just given him a yellow card for something like this and, you know, his first half and all of this. No, it's obviously, it's a completely insane thing to do. So
it was so bad that Slaven Bilic, you know, in that very rare occasion, a manager goes, yeah, you're probably right. You know, not even his own manager could come up with some, I didn't see it, or, you know, if you from a different angle, or he's not that sort of player or anything.
Well, Bilic is generally, he tends to be one of the more honest and frank managers, but yeah, you can't, there's no defending that. I would be interested to hear, say, if it had been an Arsenal player, how Wenger would have tried to make out that that was thoroughly undeserved.
Well, as Troy Deeney's pointed out, no Arsenal player would dream of doing anything like that.
But did I get this wrong, or did Andy Carroll point to his head immediately afterwards?
No, I think he was saying he was looking at the ball.
Oh, and right, going, that was, you know.
To be fair to him, he was. Yeah. But he was paying literally no attention. I mean, it's a bit like saying, I was looking at the traffic light, isn't it? So you mow over a lot of people. I mean, you know... Chris Wood is a good footballer, and it's interesting we're talking about Everton, you know, and they didn't sign a striker because it was almost like they were going for such A-list strikers that they didn't think about an Abraham or a Chris Wood who would just do the job that they need, and he scored another goal. Hey, Monday Night Football's Leicester West Brom. Who's excited?
I tend to find the football match on Monday Night Football the least entertaining thing about it.
You watch the bit before?
The bit before and the bit after. I'll watch it. I'm not excited, but I will watch it.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, why did the man climb Mount Everest? Because it's there. I will watch it because it's on.
Which do you think is the bigger ordeal? Of climbing Everest or...
Get back to me about 9:30. I'll let you know.
Man United, Liverpool, Man United maybe. I'm kind of intrigued to see what Leicester does, because on paper they don't have a squad that's that terrible, but they're now, you know, in 18th, having not won in 5.
I'm basing all of my Leicester knowledge on the first game away at Arsenal, where I thought they impressed me, and so I think they must be about 12th.
But it's an interesting thing with Craig Shakespeare and caretakers who take over and do well and then get it permanently, because I have a theory, which is caretaker managers who have been part of the club setup are often really well placed to know what is going wrong when something's going wrong, because he will have coached the team every day, he'll have been in the dressing room, he'll have seen where the players were not responding to what Ranieri was doing. So when he first took over, he knew, like, this and this and this we can fix and it'll change immediately. Now we're in a situation where he's having new problems thrown at him and he needs to find solutions to them, and we'll see how that goes.
I mean, he is there, though. I mean, you know, he's still there. If you're saying he can spot it as a caretaker.
Well, but
I suppose he's not creating the decisions.
I think it's different.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
In a way, it's different being the guy who has to take all the decisions and being the guy who's kind of working alongside of him and can look at the decisions that are being made out of a bit of a difference.
Football league time. In the Championship, Wolves went top after a 2-0 win over Villa. There's a clip doing the rounds of Wolves playing keep ball, like Brazil at 2-0 up, playing some glorious crossfield passes accompanied by the Olays. Cardiff dropped into second after losing away at Birmingham on Friday night. Excuse me. Keep it in if you want. That's the peanut butter. Only 2 wins in their last 7 games now for the early league leaders. Bolton picked up their first win of the season, the 12th time of asking. Sami Amiobi opening the scoring with a curler from outside the box in a 2-1 win. In League One, Shrewsbury are still unbeaten. They drew 1-1 at bottomside Plymouth. They're not top of the league, though. Wigan are. They beat Southend 3-0. There was some fighting in League One as well. Bristol Rovers fans clashed with police after they lost 1-0 at home to Oxford, and a female fan punched a horse. She wasn't arrested. She went inside to finish her drink. She sounds great. In League Two, Notts County and Exeter both have 29 points. Luton are third. They scored 7 at home to Stevenage. Well done to them. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll go Europe and start with Sid in Spain. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe's in Madrid. How are you, Sid?
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Let's start then with the late goals for Barcelona and Real Madrid. Luis Suarez equaliser in a 1-1 draw at Atletico.
Yeah, and it's curious this because, you know, watching, and I know obviously people during the game particularly kind of lose their heads a little bit on Twitter and so on, but watching a lot of Barcelona fans during the game, they seem to be really, really unhappy with this performance from Barcelona. I actually thought the second half was pretty good. It's true that they maybe didn't have the incisiveness of previous games, but they kept coming at Atleti, who obviously everybody knows a very good side. They created one or two pretty good chances and got the equaliser with Luis Suarez and then had that had that free kick in the last minute for Messi. And there's some lovely footage, actually, of the free kick. You've got the Atletico players in the wall, and there's a couple of photographs where they look absolutely terrified. But there's also some footage just before they take it of a couple of Barcelona players kind of saying to him, he's going to score, you know, he's going to score. And then you get the referee come over and say to them, this is the last one. You know, in other words, after this free kick, the game is over. So the whole thing comes down to this free kick, Messi against Oblak, and in the end, he hits it straight into Oblak's hands. And there's this kind of weird moment where Oblak's standing there with a ball, and everyone's sort of standing there going, "Oh, is that it then?" And I think ultimately, a 1-1 draw is kind of good for both teams.
They play Olympiacos in the Champions League. Also in that group, Juve play Sporting. Real Madrid, a late winner for Cristiano Ronaldo in Getafe.
Yeah, and a performance which didn't really convince from them. Benzema, I thought, played pretty well for around about an hour. It's the first time him and Ronaldo have played together since the Champions League final, because, of course, Ronaldo started the season with those five games of ban after he pushed the referee in the Super Cup. Benzema's had an injury. Of course, Gareth Bale is still out, and Madrid made a whole load of changes. I think if you look at the team from the Getafe game at the weekend, probably five of those starters won't start against Spurs, maybe even six. And they were struggling a little bit, but then Isco comes on as a sub, produces a lovely pass for Ronaldo at the end to win it. And Ronaldo doesn't do that celebration that he always does, in part because a couple of minutes before he missed an absolute sitter from about a metre. And I think it was relief more than anything else. Bear in mind, it's actually his first goal in the league this season.
Jim says, can Sid see Spurs getting any result against Madrid? And if so, what's the best way to get at them?
Well, I mean, it's curious this, because you look at the three games. I mean, Real Madrid started the season with three games at home and they didn't win any of them. Two draws against Valencia and Levante, and then a defeat in the last minute against Betis. And ultimately, you know, when the analysis was made after the game, particularly by Zidane, and of course he's trying to put a positive spin on it because that's the nature of the way that he does things. He's calm. He never loses his head after the games. He's always very, very kind of in control. But he talked about it being purely a case of efficiency, of missing chances. And if you look at the statistics, it was almost 80 shots across those three games, a huge amount of chances. But I think perhaps not quite as many of them are absolutely clear-cut as he would like. And I think the approach in each of those games is slightly different. Valencia are very much a defend deep and attack very, very directly kind of team. Levante were a little bit more about slowing the game down and about defending deep. Betis played much more of a possession game, and actually in the last 20 minutes or so took the game to Madrid, largely on the counter-attack, it's true, but they did take the game to them. And listening to, for example, to Bordalás, the Getafe manager this weekend, who said that he felt that Madrid are still a side that, although they evolved into a much more controlling team, a much more possession-based team at the back end of last year, particularly with Modric and Cruz, who were brilliant in the last two or three months with Isco in midfield. Bordalás was saying, you know, they're still a side that fundamentally you don't want to give them space to run into, because they're still a side that's very, very athletic, very, very dangerous on the break. And I suspect that Spurs will be conscious of that. They've not completely convinced so far this season, though, Madrid.
Valencia, they played this kind of unhinged game last night against Real Betis and are now second. Are they good again? Is this going to keep happening?
There's no doubt they're good. Yeah, they really are. I mean, it was a brilliant game, and it was an enormous amount of fun, which perhaps shouldn't be a huge surprise from Valencia and Betis. I'm going to find it here because I've just been looking at this myself. So it's 4-0 to Valencia with I think it's 12 minutes to go. There's five goals in the last 12 minutes. It's a game where nine different goal scorers in the match, only the third time that's ever happened. But the last three games for Valencia before this were 3-2, 3-2 and 5-0. Betis's last games were 4-4, 4-0 and a 1-0 victory over Real Madrid. So I suppose that the likelihood of it being pretty mad was quite high. Also because of the nature of the way they play, Betis open themselves up an awful lot. They take a lot of possession. They step very high. They allow teams the chance to run on them. And Valencia are a brilliantly worked counter-attacking side. Very, very direct when they get the ball, with a lot of men coming forward. And I think they've got a very good manager now. In fact, I think in a way you could almost look at it and say they've actually got a manager. You know, some of the people they've had over the last couple of years, they haven't been proven managers, and I think they've made an awful lot of mistakes. They cleaned out in the summer. They made a three or four big signings, not so much big signings as big departures, which in terms of the kind of the dressing room dynamics was really, really important. They've got a hyper serious manager now. They've got some good players, and Geddes, for example, at the weekend was brilliant. I think they are genuinely good again. Whether or not they can hang on to the current position, I don't think they'll finish second. The question really in Spain being asked now is whether or not they can compete for a Champions League place. And I don't think it's impossible.
Interesting, Sid. Thanks for your time, as always.
My pleasure.
Cheers. Sit out in Spain. Other Champions League fixtures. Anderlecht, PSG, Monaco, Besiktas. A bit more on Ryan Babel in a second. RB Leipzig, Porto, and Bayern Munich, Celtic, Barry, which seems like a opportune time to do Fitbar Corner.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty routine weekend in the Scottish top flight. Six games, five away wins, interestingly, including for Rangers, Aberdeen, Hearts. The only team to win at home was Celtic, who beat Dundee 1-0. They remain top with 23 points ahead of Aberdeen on goal difference. And the other big story in Scotland, which I think only the future Mrs. Rustin has commented on as a caveat at the end of last Thursday's podcast, I will struggle to be as incisive with my analysis of the Scottish international team management situation as she was. But yeah, Malky Mackay has been given the sort of caretaker role for the visit of Holland to Pataudry, I think it is, on November the 9th. And that's a sort of a controversial opinion or controversial appointment. We'll all remember he sent a series of racist, homophobic and sexist texts and emails to the director of recruitment at Cardiff City when they were both at the club between 2011 and 2014. You know, they were tasteless, horrible, vile texts. And it's kind of disturbing that someone, either he has that mindset, in which case you think, well, he shouldn't be anywhere near the job because he's clearly not a very nice bloke, or else he's so immature that he feels the need, he doesn't have that mindset, but feels the need to pretend he has just to be one of the lads or whatever. He wasn't punished at the time because the FA decided the two men involved had a reasonable right to privacy. And yes, you know, we do all say things in the company of our mates that we wouldn't say in a working environment or to other people. But Lord Owsley from Kick It Out has said Mackay deserves a second chance. People learn from the mistakes, and hopefully Malky has and will demonstrate on behalf of the people of Scotland and to the people of Scotland that he's worthy of such a position. People need to move on. He is not Harvey Weinstein.
It's interesting, but there is something really interesting about someone does something so obviously wrong, but then the liberal part of you also believes in the rehabilitation of anyone who's done something wrong.
I would agree that anyone deserves a second chance, and yeah, we all do stupid things, but he's never really actually been punished for this because he left Cardiff and went to the Wigan job, lost that job because he just didn't do very well with them. And then he more or less moves straight into a position with the Scottish FA. I mean, his reputation has taken a bit of a battering, and it must be very embarrassing for him. But otherwise, you know, I mean, we were at a thing, some charity beano, the Nordoff Robbins thing, very soon after that tech scandal blew up, and Mackay was at it. And I did notice at the time the table he was sitting at, there were quite a few empty chairs around him. But I think Richard Keys was the MC for the night. He sort of very much, you know, that other diplomat. And he very much glossed over what happened, announced Malky was here, and, oh, we should all support Malky at this difficult time. And I think Mackay possibly looked a little embarrassed and would have preferred if attention hadn't been drawn to his presence.
Do you know what? I spent about an hour in Malky Mackay's company on that Jeff Stelling walk. And I did talk to him about this whole affair. It was about 15 miles in, so I can't bloody remember because I was so knackered and angry. I was just pleased that someone was talking to me to take my mind off the issue. But it is interesting. What you wonder is, because whenever you see him, you will instantly think, oh, he's the guy that did that, right? So do you sort of feel that if someone's done that, you almost need to hear them saying, I apologize, I'm sorry about what happened a while ago, now let's get on with the press conference. Almost like apologize every time you see them do anything. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Lord Owsley, if Kick It Out say he deserves a second chance, maybe fine. I don't have a problem with that. But if Harvey Weinstein is going to be the benchmark to which we compare everyone, then pretty much everyone is fine and, you know, nothing is wrong.
Yeah. I remember, like, feeling deeply uneasy about the Malky Mackay scandal because, of course, I mean, it's completely right that people who are racist or make racist utterances should be completely ostracized. I think that's how it should go. But they were also private messages. Like, it's fair to say, if all my private messages were made public, I would probably never work again. And I think that goes for a lot of people in a lot of different industries. So I you know, that's a weird one for me. And yeah, again, if Kick It Out says, you know, I'm not going to say here and say,
no, I think
wrong.
It's, you know, it's interesting to hear that from Kick It Out, and they are better. They're more across this than any of.
But
we
the fact of the matter is, apart, like I say, apart from his reputation taking a bit of a kicking and a well-deserved kicking, he has, you know, nothing. He hasn't really suffered beyond that. But then, you know, to have a good reputation is important. So
would you say that Scotland have gone from one manager who's worried about genetics to another?
Thanks, Lars.
Has there been any sort of what's the vibe out in the field, Dominic, or was?
Well, he has had another job since, as you said, the Wigan job, and I think there was a time when he was being confronted with this. Not every press conference, but it was put to him. I guess there's a point where you have to try and move on if he's apologised and. Clearly not going to do it again, but I mean it was very unsavoury. This was a manager that had a burgeoning reputation. He was actually doing well. He'd taken Cardiff back into the top flight, and for a while he was the victim. He appeared to be the one that was being forced out by Vincent Tan, and then obviously the tables turned fairly spectacularly.
Let's go to Germany. Is that Football Corner is finished?
What about East Fife? What about East Fife? You're not mentioning East Fife.
I don't know. Sorry.
Oh, a hole in Football Corner,
oh
Barry.
Dear, you plug the dam.
Barry out. Dom, the new host of Football Corner.
That's one of the 4-2 down against Albion Rovers at home after 80 minutes. 4-3 down after 91 minutes. Win 5-4.
East 5-5.
East 5-5.
I can't believe you missed an East 5-5. Surely that's the first thing you check for.
I only noticed this because
they weren't playing 4-4, so I suppose
that was the one.
It doesn't matter so much. Thanks, Dom.
Do you check their results just because you've got Fife in your name?
Yes, exactly that. And I was writing my match report at Selhurst Park on Saturday, and I noticed they'd gone 4-2 down. I was actually, whilst I was preoccupied with what was going on at the pitch at Selhurst, I was actually a bit dismayed inside that they'd conceded a fourth at home.
Same reason I have a tattoo of Ian Rush on my chest, and you're obsessed with Monarch of the Glen, isn't it? In Germany, leaders Borussia Dortmund's club record of 41 home games without defeat went as they lost to RB Leipzig in a fun game. 3-2, both sides ended with 10 men, and they both had a penalty. Bayern a second after a 5-0 win over Freiburg. Hoffenheim make up the top four. They drew 2-2 with Augsburg. Hertha Berlin.
Bayern Munich win, that's Jupp Heynckes' fourth spell in charge of Bayern Munich, and it's his fourth win on his debut as Bayern Munich manager.
He should just keep resigning in between games. Hertha Berlin took a knee ahead of their game against Schalke on Saturday. Just before kickoff, the starting lineup linked arms, took a knee in a similar fashion to a lot of the NFL stars in recent weeks. The coaching staff substitutes also do it. This is what they tweeted. Hertha BSC stands for tolerance and responsibility for a tolerant Berlin and an open-minded world now and forevermore. Hashtag take a knee. In France, there were late goals. PSG won 2-1 at second bottom Dijon. Dijon made it 1-1 in the 87th minute, only for Thomas Meunier to score his second in injury time to win it. Second place Monaco went down 3-2 at Lyon on Friday night. Nabil Fekir with the winner in the 95th minute. And Saint-Étienne left it late, scoring the 85th and 95th minutes to beat Metz 3-1. They are third on the same points as Marseille and Nantes. And in pronunciation news, Guingamp are ninth. Italy, Barry.
Well, I suppose the big game in Italy was the Milan derby, which Inter won 3-2 thanks to a Mauro Icardi hat-trick. Despite that, there were rumours that Vincenzo Montella might get sacked from Milan if they lost that game. He hasn't been sacked at the time of recording this pod. And he was...
he will be at 2 p.m.
And we can get the future Mrs. Rushton to give us her thoughts on the matter.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, he said he was, despite the defeat, I think it was Milan's third in a row, he was very proud of his players. And the sense seems to be that, you know, that he thinks that if Milan keep playing the way they did in that game, they will improve, they will make the top four.
Two lovely finishes from Icardi, weren't they? James says, how good is he? Is he good enough for the Premier League?
He's very, very good. And I love the sort of almost sort of simplicity of the way Inter attack, because you have a guy on the right wing who's has a tremendous right foot and can put a really good cross in Candreva, and you have a guy on the left wing in Perisic who's also putting in really good crosses, and you have a guy in the box who's really good at knocking them in. It's a pretty good formula.
So
I like it.
Should sort of tell Ronald Koeman.
It could catch on. Yeah.
How should maybe do it?
No, he is a real, like, as a pure number nine, just as a guy who likes to stay in the box and doesn't like doing much else, but is a great finisher. He's fabulous.
Yeah. So elsewhere, Lazio beat Juve in Turin. 2-1 win. Paulo Dybala had a penalty to rescue a point for Juve at the death and missed. And that put the pressure on Napoli, who played Roma soon after that game ended, and they sort of belied their reputation as big game bottlers and won 1-0. So they're top of Serie A with 8 wins from 8. Inter second, 2 points behind. Lazio, Juve are already 5 points off the pace. Milan are 10th, 10 behind, and Benevento remain bottom with no points from 7 games.
Ryan Babel news, everybody. Beşiktaş lost 2-1. At, and I don't know how to pronounce this, Gençlerbirliği, maybe? Anyway, Ryan Babel subbed on in the 46th minute, sent off in the 48th minute. if you see it as well, I mean, in a sort of Andy Carroll way, his eyes were on the ball. It's like a throw-in, I think, goes over his head. So he spins round to kick it, and he forgets that there may be other humans around, and he basically just kicks a guy high in the chest. So an excellent performance from Ryan. He'll have to do something while he's suspended for us to mention him on every pod for the next few weeks. Lars, Ronnie Dyler, naked.
Yes.
Tell me more.
Yeah, he does that, Ronnie. Ronnie Dyler of Celtic fame is currently in charge of Vålerenga in Norway. Now, I have to contextualise this a bit because Vålerenga are kind of an interesting club. They're the biggest club in Oslo. But apart from fleeting periods of success, they are one of these clubs that seem to find new and more interesting ways to fail every year. You know, it's one of those clubs that should, that they are a big club in a Norwegian context, but they should be so much more successful than they are. And they've brought in Ronnie Dyla after his slightly underwhelming spell at Celtic to fix it and to get it right. And it's not quite gone to plan this season, but he'll be given time because of his pedigree, and they have a squad that needs clearing out and all of this. But it started slipping quite badly in the autumn, and they were sort of sliding towards, they were one of those teams that looked like they were about to sleepwalk straight into relegation, which would be a massive disaster for the club. And because of the nature of the club, they're kind of chronic underperformers, biggest team in the capital where a lot of the media is based. They're under, it's Norway, so it's not, you're never under much pressure really, but by Norwegian standards, Vålerenga is a tricky job. And the players were feeling that pressure. They were not performing well at all. And Ronnie Dyla decided the way to warm up for one of a really must-win game against quite a good team in Brann was to, get nudie.
I need more details than that. We're all naked at some point in the day, but there's a sensible time to do it.
Well, it was before the game, I understand. And it was just basically to get everyone to relax a bit and not take it all so serious. Okay. But I it's one of those where football is a strange industry, because I find, if I've walked into the pod studio naked, I tend to think people would get more tense, not less.
Naturally more nakedness in a football dressing room than a podcast studio.
That is a very good point. And also the manager, I think, not taking himself seriously and just being a bit relaxed about situations. I guess that's the theory. And his quote is quite good because he said something about, I do it now and again, but I can't do it too often because then it'll lose its effect. And that is very true. Mm. He would be known as the naked manager, and it would be very strange.
Do you want questions and feedback corner? Fergie Lowe, with the imminent threat of Hurricane Ophelia approaching, has there ever been a good game of football played in storm conditions? Or what's the worst stormy condition? There was a Cambridge game against Scunthorpe where it was so windy. Two of our players scored from the halfway line with clearances. One that bouncing over the keeper's the best.
I watched my local hurling club at home, Burr, play an All-Ireland final in Croke Park in the worst conditions I've ever seen Sport play. And there were advertising hoardings, like, swirling around in the air. It was like something from the Wizard of Oz landing on the pitch. Quite how the game wasn't called off, I don't know. But that was really... And we were playing this team called Dunloy from Northern Ireland, who we would have been expected to absolutely hammer. But because the conditions were so weird, they managed to get a draw, and they should have won, but yeah, that was weird. It was just surreal and probably very dangerous.
The hurling ball doesn't get as affected by the wind as much as
it would
do. Does it?
That would,
yeah. But Andrew...
Well, try hitting one into the wind and see how you get.
Well, Andrew says, has anyone ever seen a goal kick be taken that went over the keeper's own crossbar and out for a corner because of windy weather? I have. I've seen that as well.
I mean, any number of games in Norway have been played in stormy conditions, but they haven't been good. What often happens in Norway is because we have a summer league, we have to have a summer league, but we still have to start earlier than the teams far up north would really prefer. So especially Tromsø is the northernmost team in the Norwegian Premier League. They do tend to get snow during and before and after games in the early and the late part of the season. And they have an artificial surface. They actually bring out a tractor at halftime often to sort of, you know, get the snow away. And I've seen a few years back now, Alex Tetti, now of Norwich, scored a goal for Rosenborg up there, and he celebrated by creating a snow angel.
Oh, that's marvellous. Tom Hitchener writes, would you rather go bowling with Kevin De Bruyne or Eden Hazard? Dom?
Blimey. Probably De Bruyne, although... Actually,
he'd definitely win, wouldn't he, De Bruyne?
Oh, absolutely, and he'd find ridiculous angles and things like that. It's absolutely ridiculous. I think Hazard would probably... He'd probably scuttle up and down the lane, which is obviously not allowed, so...
Do you not think you would like be casting glances towards the air hockey all the time, thinking, I mean, that might be more fun than what I'm doing
that's
now?
Brutal. That's
Terrier Travel says, has Barry's dad ever treated a famous footballer's pet, Andy Townsend's guinea pig, for example?
No.
Oh.
He lives next door to a former footballer who isn't very famous.
Oh. Has he ever treated his?
No, I don't think he has any pets.
Oh. Shame, because that anecdote would have been better, wouldn't it?
I could make one up.
Do it, come on. Peggy Arfax says weasel.
Terrapins. They had he. I think the weirdest thing he's treated terrapins with conjunctivitis, which he successfully cured.
Well done.
But if you ever hold a terrapin while your dad is giving them an injection, it's quite funny because the little legs come out of each corner and just start flapping up and down.
Some feedback from last pod on the subject of me emphasising how impressive Tim Cahill's goals for Australia were, as he hadn't played a single A-League game all season. Many of you, there was only one match so far played, and Tim Cahill was on international duty for this game. What makes it even worse was, on a Thursday, I do a little bit for Fox Sports in Australia and watched a whole hour's TV programme about the first week of the A-League season. But between leaving there and coming here, I'd completely forgotten. That'll do. Barry, thanks.
You're welcome.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Don't leave it another 9 years.
See you in 2026.
I look forward to it. Hey, Lars.
Yep.
Come on.
Come on.
Why? Like, why can't
you? No,
listen, can't
no.
Just, why?
No, because
it was curry. Wasn't it?
You was it can't. Curry? Come on, was it? You can't handle the truth.
If we all have one guess, guess, right. Will you?
Curry.
Was it curry?
Your guess.
Dom, you go. First.
No, let's do all the guesses.
Okay. I'm going curry. I'm going a bit of Bombay potato that was left over.
I think it was. You'd already had a roast dinner for lunch, right? So what? You couldn't have had that big a dinner. I reckon it was. A lamb hot pot.
I'll go shepherd/cottage pie.
Ah, none of you got it. It goes on. I'm not telling you.
Will you tell us? Will you tell us?
Nope. I'm not.
What, please?
No.
Please. Why? It's like, because it's, I mean, not like,
you know what,
it's not like, did
you
kill...
Sometimes you don't get your way.
Sometimes it's not like I killed
not
my...
A familiar sensation for you, but there it is.
Oh, please.
Is the answer funnier than Max's one before we started recording, where I asked him
more
a question and the answer was, I kissed her in a jazz club. Yeah. To which we all asked, is that a euphemism?
I hope they keep this in.
It's like the magician thing. The second you reveal the trick, it's no longer interesting.
Yeah, it would be an anticlimax now, wouldn't it?
Good for you. Good for you.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.